anyway, so I always enjoy coming back to Texas, and but I live in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, which is south of Nashville. Lived there for about 10 years. So Tennessee and Texas, we're close, you know. So tonight, we're going to talk about tragedy, a life lost and found, and the hope and healing that comes through tragedy. Elliot Mooney, born July 20th, 2006, 6 pounds, 18 and a half inches. When we had the ultrasound at 30 weeks that showed many markers of trisomy 18, one of those seen was clenched fists. Between the Tuesday of my amniocentesis and the Friday of the results, I had vivid memories of my pleading to the Lord to unclench the fists. It's funny how small our minds are and how big God and His plan is. I can't put into words how grateful I am that the Lord did not unclench those fists. I love Elliot's clenched fists. I love changing Elliot's oxygen. I love that his food goes into syringes and into a pump and through a tube, and I love his webbed toes. I love his whole right ear and his partial left ear. I love the greatest accomplishment of my life is dropping a tube down his throat at 3 a.m. I love getting to see Matt be the best dad a kid could ever have. Though I'm very aware that the unknowns continue, I'm also very aware of the fullness and joy of today. God's goodness is not always packaged as we think. It's better than anything we could ever come up with. This is a blog I'm reading from these parents that had this little boy. We wish there were more times for us to share the many things we have experienced with sweet Elliot in the last 11 days, but there just isn't enough time between feedings. We celebrate Elliot's life and the miracle God has given us in him each day at 4:59 p.m. with a birthday party. Today he will be 12 days old. Each day is amazing, and we are loving being parents and seeing the many answered prayers. Please continue to pray for us as we prepare to go home, possibly tomorrow. We are asking that you would pray specifically that we would not live in fear, continued life for Elliot, and all those details of transitioning home. We've been home a week now, and we have loved being home. We packed up today, oxygen and all, and went for a big outing to the pediatrician. It was the first venture out for Elliot since being home. He did splendid, sleeping and being cute as usual. To mark the occasion, as well as introduce Elliot to the finer things in life, we headed to Starbucks for a Mooney family outing. It was great, and we thoroughly enjoyed that hint of normalcy. As far as care goes, Elliot is on oxygen and is fed through his feeding tube. His feedings are timed in order to not feed him too fast. Each feeding takes 1.5 hours, preparation and feeding, and he eats every 3 hours. That's right, quick mathematicians, that's feeding or getting ready to feed for half of the day. It's really quite simple, and he's able to do whatever while he is feeding. Mom and Dad have had a crash course lesson in nursing and parenting and have loved the chance to learn how to best take care of Elliot. I'm sitting beside Elliot. His 11 o'clock feeding is almost halfway done. Mom's asleep and the best part of my day has begun. My feeding shifts are late night and early morning. She takes over around 4:45 a.m. and cherishes her mornings with her son. Well, I promised to share that which we have been taught by Elliot. Here's just a fragment of the lesson. Jenny and I both have been struck by the fact that the fulfillment of our deepest desires is often found in the opposite of the places we were looking. Truth be told, Elliot's condition is the type of things that many, us included, fear and hope against. However, whose joy surpasses ours? Down a road we would not choose, we continue to find unspeakable joy. Truly, the Lord's ways are not our own. Joy and sorrow, side by side. I must apologize in advance for this next memory will not be done justice by my words. Elliot turned 1 month on Sunday. Hands down, favorite sentence I have ever written. Early in the day, Jenny and I talked of how we wished we had invited a lot of people over in order to celebrate. We wanted the full birthday experience for him, the whole nine yards. We decided to forgive ourselves, since things had been a tad bit crazy, and resolved to make him a cake ourselves. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Jenny heard something outside our door. We were expecting a couple who had called to come visit. Jenny yelled back to me, "Oh my, there's a lot of them." Jenny grabbed Elliot and the three of us met at our front door. There before us, outside in the sweltering heat, was 14 of our friends and 6 of their kids holding balloons and singing happy birthday. At the song's end, they all came in, bringing gifts and a birthday cake for Elliot. It was a real deal surprise party. They released 31 balloons to celebrate 31 days of life for Elliot. People were everywhere. Birthday celebrations continue each and every day. We take a picture daily with the number of days present in the photo so we can keep track. Lately, we have been attempting to spice up the pics with creativity as... Whoops, come back there, buddy. There you go. There it is, 75. Over 8 pounds in 80 days, Elliot continues to gain weight. 7 more birthday parties, 7 more baths, 7 more days with our son. I've never seen my wife more happy. I cannot portray the joy that I receive from seeing her glow as she has showed off her son. She wrote about it for something else, but I think her words paint the perfect picture. So here's what she wrote. Saturday was one of the greatest days I've ever experienced. Elliot was 86 days old, and Matt and I took him to the NICU reunion. It was a roundup, so we got to see the ever-so-serious neonatologist and sweet nurses from our 12 days in the hospital riding stick horses. I'll never forget the looks as they saw Elliot. The logic of medicine says he should not still be alive, but he is. He's strong and sweet, such a fighter. And I felt that day the way I would assume a mother would feel if her son became president or won the Heisman or developed a cure for cancer. If you would have asked me in those days in the NICU if we'd be coming to the reunion on day 86, I would not have had an answer. All I had and all I have still is a mustard seed. My faith is not big. It is small. Sometimes it feels smaller than a mustard seed even, but I am generally sure of what I hope for and sort of certain of what I do not see. God has taken that tiny glimpse of faith and done in Elliot what really he does in us all, moved the mountain of death and given life. July 20th, 2006 to October 27th, 2006. Our fighter of a son has gone to be with Jesus. We celebrate his life and revel in the fact that he is finally well. We are sad. We miss our son, but do not mourn for us. Celebrate with us. Elliot's life points us all to worship. A dad speaking at his son's funeral is probably a little strange as well, but Elliot's is a story I must tell. Jenny and I have had things to say, and I'm going to try to say them today. We also have a saying as of late, which is, go ahead and cry. We do. But if all possible, hold it in for the next couple minutes or I'll probably lose it with you. I have a tag team partner on board, so I can tap out at any moment. With that said, I apologize for reading. My communications teacher would be disappointed, but I'm just going to try to make it through. I want to thank all of you for being here today. Thank you all for joining us today to celebrate the life of a special boy who impacted so many. We view today as a celebration. We celebrate the greatest gift the Lord has ever given us. In Elliot, we enjoyed so much. We loved so much. We learned so much. Although Jenny and I had seats near the front of the class, you all joined in on the lessons and the classroom kept expanding to include people we had never even met. We all sat in awe as God himself took a sick little boy and pulled back the veil to reveal lessons about himself. An underdeveloped lung, a heart with a hole in it, and DNA that placed faulty information into each and every cell of Elliot's body could not stop the living God from screaming of himself through a child who never uttered a word. To an outsider, it may seem nothing short of foolish to credit all of this teaching to Elliot. But 1 Corinthians says the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. It goes on to say that God's wisdom is unlike ours and his tools are not what we would imagine. His tools are not the ones we would craft. Not a pulpit, not a slick presentation, not a best-selling book, but a 6-pound boy with trisomy 18. God found great pleasure to take a lowly thing in the eyes of the world and show truth. Our God teaches that to become the greatest, I must become least. That as a believer, I have total freedom and yet strive not to sin. And ultimately, that I find life in none other than the death of man named Jesus. So today we propose a new standard. How do you measure a life? By years, by esteem, by productivity? Elliot Hartman Mooney, 99 days, 98 birthday parties, 18 nurses, 17,557 visits to his website, 0 minutes unattended. Although these statistics are fun, they all fall woefully short of a metric whereby to judge Elliot's life. We propose that Elliot's life be measured by impact. Thus, truly, his life was a full life. Thank you, Elliot. You were the joy of mine and your mom's life. And here they are today with 3 children. Everyone has a story. The trouble is that we all come together and look as nice and normal as we can, putting on our best smile to match our best Sunday summer dress and allows us to keep our mask on or hide the hurt in our soul. So let's stop pretending we don't cry and when alone and that we avoid certain people and we avoid certain places, that perhaps we fear our faith has let us down. You are not alone. Romans 12, verses 15 says, "Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn." Who is Paul talking to? Everybody else but me. Loss and death and grief has come to many before me. But when it's yours, it's very different. And so sometimes we don't recognize people like Hannah and the persecution she went through, being childless and being in a step-parenting situation. How about the story of Mary and Martha when they buried Lazarus? Or the story of Mr. and Mrs. Job when their children all died? Or Joseph's father, Jacob, when he was told an animal had torn apart his son? Or Eve, who had one son, kill her other son? Or the betrayal of Judas? Or Mary, who watched her Jesus, her son, be crucified? Real people with real lives. Here's a couple more real people. Her name is Brenda. Some of you may be able to relate to Brenda. No one knows. Brenda's a dedicated Christian wife and mother. She harbors a double secret, her husband's agnosticism and alcoholism. Brenda is determined to exemplify the character of 1 Peter 3:1 and win her husband without a word by the godly example of her consistent and faithful life. She may succeed or she may not, but each day she tries with only the strength that God supplies. Each day, the burden is there, and some days it seems beyond bearable as she seeks to maintain her own faith as well as to work influence her son for good. It's not easy, but she's determined. Brenda has a story. And there's the story of Pap. Mike and Janice live on a picturesque ranch in the piney woods of East Texas near Lufkin. Next to their home was the residence of their daughter and son-in-law, Jennifer and Brent, along with their grandchildren, Micah 4 and Luke 2. Never had a grandfather been crazier about his grandkids than was Pap. He loved lifting them into the cab of his big John Deere and taking them for rides around the ranch. They had a special bond. Mike never saw him on that fateful February day. When little Luke heard Pap start the big tractor, he bolted from the house and ran toward his grandfather. Mike positioned the tractor into place to secure a roll of hay, and once affixed, pulled out and through the gate toward the pasture. Micah, who had followed her little brother outside, saw the accident and ran back inside, yelling for her mother and telling her that Luke was hurt. Jennifer, her heart beating wildly, dropped what she was doing and ran from the house where she came upon Luke's lifeless body lying on the ground. She knelt over her son and realized he was gone. Mike lives each day with the realization of the accident, yet it was Mike's strength of faith that led his family throughout the crisis. The next Sunday, Mike, an elder of the church, walked with his family into worship services. Mike in the lead, and by so doing, Mike led not only his family, but also an entire congregation to a greater understanding about faith and trust, even in things that you don't understand. I don't question why, says Mike. The why is beyond my understanding. And then he adds, but I have learned that when the hours are darkest, God's grace is the greatest. Pap has a story. Sometimes there are accumulated losses. A lot of things happening all at once. I've got a little test for you all. And we've got some papers that I want to pass out to each one of you. And I want you to take just a few moments to look over all of those scenarios. And next to each one are points. And when you're looking at those, I want you to circle what's happened to you within the past year. Just within the past year. As to whether or not that has happened to you. And then we'll talk a little bit about how much things that happen in your life impact you in all kinds of ways. So just take a few moments. And if any of those have happened to you in the past year, circle. Okay. For the sake of time, we'll kind of move on. But those with a score of over 300 have an 80% chance of contracting a major illness, being in a major accident, or becoming depressed. Scores between 150 and 300 are people who are 50% at risk of falling ill within the next 2 years. Do you need those numbers again so you can add those up later? 300 or more, 80% chance of contracting a major illness, being in a major accident, or becoming depressed. Between 150 and 300, 50% chance of falling ill within the next 2 years. What that says is that life can hit us hard any day, any time, any age, in any way. So how do we cope? Matthew 11, 28 through 30 says, "Come to me all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy, and my burden is light." You can't do that unless you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. You won't be willing to give that over to Him unless you've developed that personal relationship. Jesus Christ says to you, "Come to me." Are you tired? Come to me. Are you emotionally burdened? Come to me. Are you suffering with disease? Come to me. Are you experiencing loss from death or divorce? Come to me. Is there just sin in your life? Come to me. Give it to him. Let him have it. James 1 and verse 2 says, consider it pure joy. Consider it whole gladness. Consider it always joy, my brother, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Well, why do I need perseverance? Because perseverance is victory over trial. Victory over trial presents his elect with the crown of life, which God promises to us who love him. I've not always felt joy with my trials. In fact, there have been times when I've been mad at God, doubted his love. But those are emotions. Those are feelings. They come and go. Is that where we place our trust, are on those feelings? Our love, our faith for God, and all that he's done for us, what else does he have to do? Is there more to do for you or for me in addition to him having given his only son to be crucified for you? Is there more that he has to do to prove how much he loves you? He loves you. He does not want you to hurt. There are four truths to trial. Four truths to trial. Number one, trials are necessary. Trials are necessary. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 through 7. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These have come so that your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. In Psalm 119, verse 71, it was good for me to be afflicted so that I may learn from you. God cannot use you greatly until he has broken you completely. God cannot use you greatly until he has broken you completely. And by that we mean until he receives the glory and the praise for whatever is going on in your life. He doesn't have you. And that's why these trials come. Now, a side note here. Some people get stuck here. They're always in a trial. They never rise above their trials. They never let God help them. They'd rather tell you how terrible life is. Woe to those who never find joy to rise above the trials of life in order to give God the glory and the praise. Number two, trials are distressing. In the second half of 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6, the second half of that verse says, you may have had to suffer. You may have been distressed. In the book, A Grace Disguised, the author notes, though suffering itself is universal, each experience of suffering is unique. A loss of an uncle and a loss of a son is lost, is a loss. But each has its own kind of suffering. You cannot compare the two. And sometimes we're bad about that. I remember David Lanfear, who wrote in this in the book, A Life Lost and Found, when his son had passed away in a vehicle, a motorcycle accident. And there were hundreds of people who came to that funeral. And you know, if any of you have been in that yourself, you know, a lot of people come and you don't remember what people say, but people try to do their best and say something kind. But one thing he remembered is a young person who came through the line and said to him, I know how you feel. I lost my uncle last year. And David said, I said, thank you. He said, but inside I wanted to scream, I have lost my son. It is not the same. So everyone's grief is unique and it's different. Number three, trials come in various ways. Different shapes, different sizes, different shades and colors. There's no one size that fits all. It could be physical, it could be emotional, it could be relational, it could be financial or spiritual. It could come quickly, or it could come over an extended period of time. It could be public, it could be private. It could be related to your sin. It could be related to someone else's sin, or it may not be related to sin at all. Job suffered loss of children and health. Hosea, loss of his wife. Jesus, loss of his life. And Paul, who suffered with a thorn in the flesh. Trials come in various ways. Number four, trials have a purpose. Trials have a purpose. It's a trial for you to develop your maturity. That's the reason, to help you develop maturity. Will we cave or fall away under the pressure of suffering? Or like the refining of gold in the fire, will we come out shining? This doesn't mean that you will never, ever have another emotional day. Trials and tragedies leave scars. Scars are reminders of where we've been, not where we are or where you're going. Grief can help you declutter your life. Grief can help you capture today. Grief can help you value your family more. Grief can help you pray more. Grief can help you help others. So what can you do to help someone who's grieving? In a physical way, most of us do the very comfortable to-go thing. Food. Food. And that's fine. And people may be hungry, and people may not. But that's something you can do. I think it's important to know that the tendency is, and not that we intentionally do this, but the tendency is to take food for a day or two, a week or so, and then everybody goes back to their life. My suggestion to you is that if you have someone grieving over the loss of any kind, you plan out about 6 months of food, maybe a year. It goes a lot longer than just a few days after a funeral. Send cards, send notes, send texts with scripture. Help with children. Send flowers. How about Sherry's Berries? Any of you had those? You ever had Sherry's Berries? Oh, you need to have Sherry's Berries. They are good. I sent Sherry's Berries to my husband and son for Valentine's Day. Yes, I was their favorite wife and mother for that day. Mm-hmm. Make calls to people. Shop for groceries. Clean dishes. Clean the house or hire it done. Take a person out for the evening. Ask them what is helpful. Ask them what's not helpful. And please do not say, if there's anything I can do, let me know. They will not call you. I know what people mean when they say that, but actually, that is just a way to feel better about yourself. So, just go do. Don't ask. If you need me, call me. Emotionally support, a hug or a holding of a hand. Do you have a remembrance of that person, maybe a picture or something they did for you that you could share? Let them have it. Encourage conversation, but don't push it. And if they want to know about your experience, share. Otherwise, do not volunteer what happened to you on and on and on, because they really don't care. In your book, in your booklet, there's a story of Gabriel. There's a poem written by Gabriel. The Three Things I Live For. Did any of you know Gabriel at all? Anybody know him? Okay. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Gabriel. This is written by Gabriel's mother, Debbie. Debbie's a good friend of mine. But Debbie only became a good friend of mine after the tragedies in her life. Debbie has a story. And you can see a picture of her up at the top. You may not see it very well, but that's a picture of her on that page. And she says, I graduated from high school in 1972, set off to college, and met the man of my dreams. The next year, we married. Within a few years, he began to preach at the small church where we worshiped. He was preaching for the Church of Christ, the Lord's Church. And we settled down to life as I expected it, only it wasn't what I expected at all. Almost from the beginning, he exhibited a Jekyll and Hyde personality with radical mood swings and unexplained rages. Early on, I felt I was able to help pull him out of the dark moods, but as time passed, I realized I couldn't. It was frightening and unpredictable behavior, and his episodes gradually increased in frequency and intensity. He often locked me out of our bedroom if I said or did anything that displeased him. We lived on a farm in rural Alabama near Birmingham, and late one night, he got so angry with me that he drugged me from the bathtub onto the front porch and locked me outside our home. He wouldn't let me back in until I said what he wanted to hear, but that was only one of many similar incidents. I loved the good and kind man he could be and hated the scary, violent stranger that seemed to take hold of him more and more often. I cannot count the number of times he shook me like a rag doll and drug me by my hair, knocking my glasses off. I constantly hid the bruises on my arms and legs. As his behavior became increasingly abusive, he began to behave inappropriately with a 22-year-old woman he had befriended. And he moved her in there with him. When I confronted him about her, he clamped his hand over my nose and mouth so that I couldn't breathe. I truly thought I was going to die. And that happened more than once. Despite my protests, he openly flaunted his relationship with the 22-year-old with weekly horseback rides and ice skate nights. As he spent more time with her, his behavior at home worsened. He began to withdraw and seclude himself in our basement. He had virtually no relationship with our sons or with me. Our marriage was in extraordinary crisis. He wanted me to run, but I refused. I was committed to persevere because I'd committed to God to do it. I prayed daily that God would intervene and save our family. I was in the fight of my life. I wish I could tell you that everything worked out, but in April of 1993, after nearly 20 years of a difficult, heartbreaking marriage, our lives took a disastrous turn. Child support was sporadic and unreliable, and I couldn't afford the mortgage payments, so we moved in temporarily with my parents. A couple months later, they generously helped us purchase a mobile home, and we tried to start a new life. I felt like my life was over, but God knew differently. Had I looked closer, I would have seen how compassionate He was. Family and friends provided for us over and over. I don't know how we would have gotten by otherwise. Nonetheless, it was a dreary time, and I was angry. I felt like my sons and I were robbed of the life we were supposed to have, not the one we actually lived. I was so blinded by what I thought I'd lost that I couldn't see what I still had. I spent too much time grieving for what I expected and too little time thankful for my blessings. I thought it was the most difficult of times, but didn't know that the worst was yet to come. I was so busy with mom duties one day at my job on January 31st, 1994, I specifically recall telling a coworker at the end of the day, "Now I have to go home to my second job. How I wish I'd never said that. If I'd only known." The next day was a cold Tuesday morning. The boys were still in their beds, and as I prepared to leave, I told them I loved them and kissed them goodbye. Gabriel's eyelids fluttered, but he didn't wake. I hurried out the door. About an hour later, one of my coworkers came to the desk where I stood, put her arms on each side of me, and quietly said, "Your boys have been in an accident." It strangely felt like an out-of-body experience. I remember thinking, okay, you knew someday something like this could possibly happen. So how are you going to deal with it? I said nothing, but shook as I gathered my things. Three members of my office volunteered to drive me to the hospital and accompany me out of the shop. It was a large building, and as I walked to the door, people began to gather with sad looks on their faces. When I got to the back door, I turned to Peggy, one of my coworkers, to ask if my boys were all right. She said, "Debbie, please don't ask me any more questions." At that moment, I realized that one of my, or both of my boys could be gone, and I began to cry. The ride to Birmingham Children's Hospital was the longest ride of my life. When we reached the hospital, my parents, brother, and our friend Sheriff Jones was there, and as I hurried to them, my brother Dan gathered me in his arms. I hoped against hope that he would tell me they were okay, but as I looked into his eyes, he whispered, "Deb, Gabriel did not make it." I fell onto his shoulders and cried, "Not my Gabriel. Not my precious Gabriel." I couldn't believe this was happening. None of it seemed real. I wanted to wake up and find that it was a very bad dream and that everything was right in the world, but it wasn't. I later learned that when Gabriel and Nathaniel were almost to school, Gabriel crossed the yellow line a mere 15 inches and met an oncoming car. They collided, and Gabriel died instantly. At the scene of that accident was Gabriel's backpack. In that backpack was this poem. This happened on February 1st. And as you can read that, you can tell that Gabriel, as 16-year-old young man, had been putting God first. And I'll tell you what happened with Gabriel. A few days before this accident, there were some boys that had asked him to get together and go out and go bowling. And he said, okay, and he went, and he got there, and he called his mom and said, "Mom, they're drinking, and I can't stay, so I'm coming home." And she's like, okay. That accident then happened. And between those times, the kids who had been with him at the school were making fun of him, calling him all kinds of names because he wouldn't drink with them. At that funeral, all those kids came. And each one of them had a little piece of paper. And they all went up to his casket. And then that little piece of paper, each one of them said, Gabriel, I am so sorry. We never know when life's going to hit us and hit us hard. But we have to find the blessing in that God will always, always be with us. He will never forsake us. He will never leave us. Life has tragedy. Life has hope. Life has healing on your journey. But only, only when the Lord has your hand to guide you or his arms to carry you through your deepest valley.